There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's no secret the Earth's climate is changing, and changing fast. Severe, pervasive, and irreversible impacts, says a new UN draft report on our greenhouse gases. For thousands of years, humans have expanded their footprint on Earth, overcome setbacks, and kept on growing. Have we reached the limit of that pattern? Plus, on the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, we'll check in on the American wild. This hour on Point, humans pushing nature and the wild. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How far can we, will we, take human dominance of the planet? Are we at the limit? Are we beyond it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, on the 50th anniversary today of the signing of the U.S. Wilderness Act, we'll talk with longtime wilderness ranger and nature writer Jordan Fisher Smith. But first, to the whole planet and the human grip on it. Joining me now from New York is Ruth DeFries, environmental geographer, professor of sustainable development in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology at Columbia University, MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. Her new book is The Big Ratchet: How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. It's been called a message of hope. Ruth DeFries, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Ratchet is a mechanical word. It's a powerful word. What's the pattern of ratchet that you're describing here over thousands of years? Humans, nature, and ratchet. What's the ratchet?
A ratchet is a tool that works in one direction. So we turn it and ratchet up, and then we can't go backwards. So that's the pattern that we see throughout the long arc of human history, that we figure out some kind of technology to produce more food, to increase population. That runs into some problem. We figure out some other solution, and we keep ratcheting up and ratcheting up. And that takes us to the current day, where our imprint on the planet is so pervasive.
To what you call the big ratchet. We'll look at that. But before we get there, you take us back 12,000 years or so to when we shifted as a species from being foragers to being farmers. And take us through a couple of the sort of acute chapters of ratchet. You've got a pattern here that you describe. We ratchet up through human ingenuity and discovery, what our exploitation of nature or our harvesting of nature. We get to a point where we can't sustain it. It falls apart. We think up something new. We ratchet up again. Take us through a couple of those in the history of that 12,000 years, if you would.
So as you just said, Tom, probably the biggest ratchet that has occurred in human history was our transformation from being hunter-gatherers to being farmers, when people figured out how to domesticate crops, domesticate plants, and then domesticate animals. What happened with that ratchet was that population indeed grew very rapidly because it was possible to produce more food, but our diet suffered. Our diets became starchier, people became shorter in stature, life expectancy reduced, diseases like smallpox emerged. So with that ratchet up also came these problems that then had to be overcome. Another problem that occurred with the transformation to being farmers was that we then faced the issue of soil fertility, that when we grow crops, then each time we harvest the crop, the nutrients are coming out. So with settled agriculture, then the problem is, how do you keep those nutrients recycling? So a lot of the book is actually about how humanity has come up with very clever, ingenious solutions to to keep our soils fertile that really go into the current day.
And yet we've done it again and again. It brings us, through lots of blood, sweat, and tears, and, as you would have it, progress here to the 20th century and the big ratchet, where you say we've passed another kind of boundary or a shift as fundamental just in the last century as our transition from forager to farmer more than 10,000 years ago. What was the transition you see in the 20th century, the big ratchet, Ruth?
Yeah, well, the big ratchet, in the last 50 years, the amount of food produced has just increased vastly, has increased in greater proportion to the growth in population, which itself has been very explosive. So I find this time period of the big ratchet that we're now on the crest of very transformative, perhaps as transformative as the shift from being hunter-gatherers to being farmers. In two ways. One is that we have such an abundance of food. There's enough food in the world to feed the whole population. That doesn't mean everyone is fed adequately, tragically not. But there is an abundance of food. So we've shifted from shortage into abundance. That has also enabled us to become an urban species that we have never been before. In 2007, we crossed the threshold. More than 50% of the people in the world lived in cities, in urban areas. And that is expected to increase by the middle of the century. About 80% of us will be living in cities. And that is a fundamentally different way of getting our food, interacting with nature, our relationship with nature, a very transformative shift.
The big ratchet, then, which has pushed agriculture to such incredible productivity and put it over so much of the globe, has also brought big consequences for Earth. I mean, we were already transforming it, but now we transformed it like never before. It has scared a lot of people. It's excited some people. You describe what you see as two sort of misguided reactions to the point that we're at right now. One may be too optimistic and one may be too pessimistic. I want to talk about that, but describe those if you would.
Well, there's a lot of pessimism, a lot of predictions of doomsday and catastrophe and calamity, and we are absolutely correct to be concerned. There have been predictions in the past of similar kinds of calamities, of famine, such as Malthus in the end of the 17th century, and later on, several other predictions that I go through in the book, of these impending calamities that didn't turn out to be that way because some unforeseen solution came to the fore. So based on that pattern of history, of course, we can never be able to predict what might occur in the future. But based on that pattern of history and these ingenious solutions that we've come up with, I take from that an optimistic story out of that. There's also reason to be pessimistic. What we see from this long history, this story of how we've produced more and more food, is that we're always vulnerable. We'll never be able to check the box and say we're done with that problem. We're interacting with nature on such a grand scale and manipulating such a complex system, which is our planet, that there will always be repercussions. There will always be new problems. There will always be new ways to manipulate that. And we are always vulnerable. So if you take that from a pessimistic point of view, you can always be concerned about that. There really are no silver bullets. But I take away from this story some hope that we are ingenious. We have solved many problems in the past. It's been a lot of hard work, but our long history shows a lot of ingenuity.
You know, I would love to jump right on there with you because it's very comforting. As I read that, I found myself thinking, though, in all of our past sort of ratchets up and then getting smacked down by the cost of our human growth and progress, as we looked for solutions and ways to bounce back, we were always surrounded by a bounty that dwarfed us. Now, as we head toward 9 billion people and the impacts on the whole planet are So great, and you describe them, agriculture posing a direct risk to the climate, you write. The Holocene climate itself at risk. Millions of species, prospects looking grim. Doesn't that change the setting for this pattern of ratchet and regeneration? What if we're up against limits that just don't permit that old pattern anymore?
Well, that's really up to us. That's where we are at this point in history. We're at the crest of this big ratchet, and we see these problems before us. We see unhealthy diets from this abundance of food. We see inequitable distribution. We see environmental issues like we've seen in Toledo with fertilizer runoff and monocultures and loss of species.
Lake Erie,
and, And so on. But we have choices. We have choices about our diets. We have choices about how society chooses to use fertilizer, to use the land. So my perspective is that I don't think that the doomsday scenarios take us to where we need to be. I think where we need to be at this point, we're in this hatchet cycle from the big ratchet that has occurred over the last couple of decades, is to think about what the next steps are. Think about the solutions. Think about this amazing ingenuity that we have and this amazing planet that we have, and overcome those problems that the big ratchet has created.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ruth DeFries, MacArthur Genius Grant winner, professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology at Columbia University, and author of The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. It's really about twisting nature. We've done it for thousands of years. To feed more and more of us, we're looking at how far humankind can push it and whether we are now at some kind of limit. Is it a limit that's beyond human ingenuity to solve? What price might be involved in solving it? Ruth DeFries joins us from New York. And Ruth, you've got this pattern of ratchet, that is, ratchet up agricultural production and the civilization that sits atop it, reach some limit where the hatchet comes down and we pay a price in pain, then pivot and ratchet up again. Just if that pattern looks kind of immutable to you, what does the hatchet look like right now? Is it coming down on us now? And describe it. What's it look like?
Yeah, Tom, I think we are seeing the hatchets that are falling from this incredibly big ratchet that we've just witnessed. And to me, the biggest hatchet is the fallout from abundance on diets. Just as the diets got worse when humanity switched from being forager to being farmer, now there's obesity spreading throughout the world, and not just in the industrialized world, throughout the developing world, increase in obesity that's coming from the abundance of sugars, abundance of fats. And to me, that's the biggest hatchet and the biggest opportunity to move in a different direction.
This may sound like a quibble, but let me ask on that. I mean, obesity is bad. It cuts life short and has all kinds of bad consequences. But you could step back and say it's not as bad as climate change, which could, as you write, bring down the whole Holocene climate that we've so prospered in, wipe out millions of species, make our whole system of agriculture, I mean, maybe it should, make it look unsustainable.
Well, yeah, that again, it's up to us. So our entire civilization, since we've become farmers for the last 10,000 years, has been in this relatively stable climate of the Holocene. So all of our infrastructure, our whole civilization is founded around the basis of this relatively stable climate, although it's variable, of course. But climate is one of many factors that put pressures on societies, or climate variability. There's all sorts of pressures that are going on now. Urban migration, the more connected world, which is both a positive and a negative. So there are lots and lots of big changes going on in the world. And the ingenuity part of it comes in with whether we'll be able to adapt to these changing conditions, whether agriculture will be able to adapt. We know that, you know, if we grow different crops in different places, breed different crops, change diets, then the question is not so much whether climate change will occur, because we know it is, but whether we'll be able to adapt to these changes.
I'm trying to get a sense of your balance of hope and fear around the urgency of this. I mean, you've got people out there now who are chaining themselves to fences and going to jail and laying across tracks trying to stop oil out of Canada and the Keystone Pipeline and all the rest. How urgent do you think the need for change in our current style of agriculture is, Ruth?
Well, you're right. I myself internally debate against those two sides. But when we step back and look at this long arc of human history and all of these ingenious ways that we've come out of problems and come up with dealing with problems, such as, you know, carrying human waste from cities back to the fields to keep soils fertile, picking up bison bones, all of these really very clever, ingenious ways.
For fertilizer back in the United Kingdom, the bones of buffalo.
Exactly, exactly. So when we step back and just take ourselves out of the current day and look at that very big pattern and that big arc of history, that to me that gives some hope that we are ingenious, that when the problems really become severe, we do figure out our ways around them. But that's not without a lot of hard work. And of course, there's no assumption that will occur in the future either. There's no automatic pivot and no reason to think that we will or we won't. It's really up to us what we choose the future to be.
Of course, there is a timetable. It can be faster or slower or not at all. I mean, your muddled through message can sound, I imagine, to some environmentalists like a surrender to deeper devastation than may be necessary.
I don't mean it to be that kind of message. I mean it to be a message of let's get to work and work on the problems. Work on the solutions instead of focusing on understand the problems and work on the solutions.
Jane, Ruth DeFries is with us, author of The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Let me go to John, calling from Pine River, Wisconsin. John, you're on the air with Ruth DeFries. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a comment, and I was just up in the Arctic for 3 weeks, floating the Porcupine River. And I came across a number of folks from the Vinukwitchin Athabascans, from Inuvik and Old Crow to Fort Yukon and Fairbanks. And I got to talk to a lot of them. It was a beautiful area. When we crossed the Alaska border, we were in the Arctic National Wildlife Area. Mm-hmm. And their story, which is just not heard, is that they are experiencing the permafrost melting and jacking up their cabins, and all the buildings that they build have to have jacking points now, and the methane that's forming on the surface, which is 10 times worse than the carbon dioxide that is giving us problems. Mm-hmm. With climate change. And, you know, in just a brief mention of the Wilderness Act, I just can't even imagine messing around with changing the laws and beheading the wilderness, wild areas. These people up there are, they're still somewhat of a native people that follow the caribou herds, and they're dependent on the red salmon that no longer comes up the Porcupine River from the Yukon.
Yeah, John, I know that area well, the Porcupine, and up by Anwar, know it very well. You've just come back, so how does Ruth's message strike your ear that with a little ingenuity we can turn this around?
I don't think you can turn wilderness areas around after you contaminate them with a human touch. It's just not possible. And we're facing the extinction of species in these areas.
And of course, in a period of climate change, the human touch touches everything, whether you cross the border or not. John, thanks for that report right back from Alaska. Ruth, let me get one more and I'll bring it to you. Michael in Burlington, Vermont. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. What I find disturbing in this whole conversation is population of the human race spreading and spreading and spreading.
Headed for 9 billion now, we're told.
Up to 9 billion. At what point, you know, I sort of see the Earth as a body, like our body, and the human race, unfortunately, like cancer cells. And when your guest talks about ratcheting up the ability to bypass this and figure out that, what we're blindly doing as the population grows and the demands on the environment and all the other species, that like dumb cancer cells, we just keep growing and growing and growing and figure ways, and it never occurs to us that we're going to kill the host body.
Michael, let me hold that one and get just one more. I'll take it all to Ruth. We've got Alaska. We've got humans as cancer cells. Mary in Bastrop, Texas. Mary, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. Let me talk. Mm-hmm. I agree with the last two gentlemen. We're just putting a Band-Aid on the solution, and one thing we can probably do to help it is to stop making people until we can get everything sustained and right. We're just making more people than we can feed, house, or clothe.
But Ruth says we have always ratcheted up, and we'll ratchet up again. We'll figure it out.
When you keep on ratcheting it up, you're going to strip it, and we won't be able to ratchet no more.
Mary, I appreciate your call. Ruth, there's a smorgasbord for you. Alaska in trouble right now, and John just doesn't see how it can go on. Our caller from Burlington, Vermont, who sees humans at some point, you know, you would describe it admiringly as ratchet and ingenuity, but he sees it as almost like a cancer on the planet. And Mary says there is a limit where you just strip it, and there's nothing left to be ingenious with.
Yeah, thanks to the callers for those questions. I'll address Michael and Mary's question first, if that's okay, mm-hmm. related
yep.
to population. And certainly it's true our population has expanded enormously and will increase to 9 billion people by the middle of the century. That's what's expected. But we have passed the peak of population growth. What we expect after the middle of the century, or what demographers expect, is that population will then stabilize. So we will be past this enormous explosion. And the reason that we expect this stabilization in population is because as people, particularly women, get more access to education and to jobs, and girls are schooled, and lifestyles increase, and particularly as people urbanize, then they have less children. So that happened in this country, happened in Europe, and now that's happening around the world, that with the improvements in lifestyles, then the number of children that people have goes down. And you can probably think about your own family in that respect. I know
we've
I
got that, but
can.
If you stabilize at 9 billion or something near it, how does that jibe with the carrying capacity, if I can use that phrase, of the planet?
Yeah. Well, carrying capacity is an important concept in ecology. When we apply it to humans, it's a good concept to think about, but it becomes a much more complicated concept because it's malleable, the carrying capacity, because we can move things around the world, because we can increase the amount of food that a given land area can occur. So carrying capacity as a very finite number, when we apply it to humanity, doesn't really hold up in the way that it would hold up for other species. Although clearly we live on this amazing planet, and that is the basis for our entire existence, the resources that we get from the planet.
Of course, ask the passenger pigeon about how it looks from their perspective, I guess. Catherine in Austin, Texas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Catherine.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a really interesting conversation. My comment is I have a great concern that the whole dialogue in this conversation seems to be about humankind, and the impact that we're having is not just on humans. The downside is not obesity in humans. I think the downside is loss of species, other species.
Kevin, I hear the same. Ruth writes about it, but nevertheless, it seems human-centric. We'll pick it up. Ruth, you write, with the lush rainforests of South America, Southeast Asia, and Central Africa the only viable places left for the plows and chainsaws to clear, the prospects for thousands, perhaps millions of species look grim. If we're not just human-centric, does this ratchet or our next chapter, you know, if we're going to try and be sustainable at 9 billion or anything like it, does that mean others have to go? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, thank you very much for that comment, Catherine. Certainly, the diversity of life on this planet is one of the amazing features that, as far as we know, does not exist on any other planet, and is the basis for our existence and for all life. So you're right. The book itself does take a rather human-centric point of view, but that's not to say that we don't depend on this diversity of life that we see. As Tom said, the remaining places to expand forest are into the rainforest, into the Amazon.
Expand agriculture,
expand agriculture, are into these very diverse, incredible ecosystems in the rainforest. And that's been my career, really, is working on deforestation. And now, without being too overly optimistic, we're starting to see some very positive direction for reducing deforestation and reducing the loss of tropical forest. And that's with a lot of hard work and a lot of effort on the part of a lot of people. In Brazil, for example, deforestation has reduced by about 70% in the last 8 or 9 years. That's not to say that this is a problem that we don't have to worry about, but there are some positive directions.
You described that
we can produce the food that we need without decimating the rainforest.
You opened the book with describing yourself sitting on a log in decimated rainforest in Brazil, weeping at how much has been lost. If our ingenuity is going to be brought into play, and I guess it had better be in a hurry, in what direction? We just got a minute here, but in what direction to make this next leap without just trashing the place, Ruth?
Well, one of the major things that we can do is really think about our diets. We know that eating lots of meat, not that I'm here to tell people what to eat, but eating lots of meat takes a heavy toll on the planet, and it also takes a heavy toll on our health. So to me, that's the one thing that people can really think about in their day-to-day lives.
Of course, we just had the report that came out this week saying high protein, high fat, better health. You can just hear people reaching for the meat counter when they hear that.
It was also about nuts and avocados and oils from vegetables.
And sustainability, you say, above all. Maybe that's where our breakthrough comes, figuring out how to do it not by cutting down new forests, but by figuring sustainable ways to support the population.
Yes, exactly.
Ruth DeFries, her big new book is The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. You're keeping your optimism up, Ruth.
I am. Of course, we never know what will happen in the future, and it is up to us.
The pattern, she says, is ratchet up, hatchet, where we get whacked around, pivot, and ratchet again. See how far the human race can take that. Ruth DeFries in New York City at Columbia University. Thanks very much for joining us, Ruth.
Thank you so much, Tom.
In a moment, the Wilderness Act of 1964. It turns 50 years old today. We'll look at how our wilderness is coping with our age of climate change. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On September 3rd, 1964, 50 years ago today, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Wilderness Act. It set aside land, quote-unquote, untrammeled by man, as it said. It would set aside millions of acres to be protected, wild. Today it covers more than 100 million acres, 5% of the United States. But nothing is immune from change, and climate change in particular, so we are checking in. Behind us, behind me right there, recorded in Alaska by acoustic ecologist Bernie Krause, the sound of Chichagof Island contains the West Chichagof-Yacobi Wilderness, about 65 miles northwest of Juneau, Alaska. Let's go back those 50 years. Here it was September 3rd, 1964, President Johnson signing the Wilderness Act into law, protected more than 9 million acres of federal land and created the legal definition of wilderness in the United States. Here's the president then.
This is a very happy and historic occasion for all who love the great American outdoors, and that, needless to say, includes me. The two bills that I'm signing this morning are in the highest tradition of our heritage as conservators as well as users of America's bountiful natural endowments. The Wilderness Bill preserves for our posterity, for all time to come, 9 million acres of this vast continent in their original and unchanging beauty and wonder.
Original and unchanging beauty and wonder, and yet the whole planet is changing. Joining me right now is Jordan Fisher-Smith, nature writer, wilderness adventurer. He spent 21 years working as a park and wilderness ranger in California, Wyoming, Idaho, Alaska. His latest essay on the U.S. Wilderness Act of 1964 is in the American environmental magazine Orion. It is headlined "The Wilderness Paradox." Jordan Fisher-Smith, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
What is the paradox, sir, 50 years on?
Well, the Wilderness Act, well, let's say, you know, how far we are from that. We're sort of close yet far. People were flying around on jet planes. It was September of 1964. The Beatles were on tour in the U.S. America had almost 15,000 service members in Vietnam. The Warren Commission was releasing its report on the assassination of President Kennedy. And Congress touched the eternal, placing these 9 million acres under permanent protection. And I think that what people imagined at that time was that you drew a good line around it. You made sure that people didn't cut roads into it or cut timber down. And then you let nature take its course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it hasn't exactly turned out that way. It turns out that there's a long history of tweaking these places, manipulating them, intervening in their affairs, generally for good reasons, sometimes not. And that's what I've written about in this paradox, is that the idea of wilderness seems to be leaving it alone, yet it's really never been left alone to its own devices.
So what are the different perspectives on wilderness that get played out, that you've seen played out in this half century, Jordan?
Well, I think that at the time of the Wilderness Act, the view that ecologists held of nature was one of a great and ponderous motion towards stability and eternal quietness, mm-hmm. you know, a kind of what was called the climax ecosystem. And during the intervening years, in this 50 years, we have a new sense of how nature works, and it's really one of constant change. So when wilderness administrators started out, they thought their job was just to protect these things and keep them the same. Well, it turns out they never really have been the same. If you look at the history of life on Earth, it's always been one of change. So then the problem begins, how do you distinguish change that is undesirable from possibly from human causes from natural change? And that's where it really started to get complicated.
Whether you just draw a line around it and step back, or whether what you come in to sort of clean it up as what you drew around a line around changes. The Everglades, for example.
Well, I wrote about the Everglades because it's sort of the on one end of the spectrum of intervention. And this article that I've written about, written in Orion, is about this spectrum of how much managers and scientists have felt they needed to intervene in the affairs of nature and wilderness. Everglades is definitely at the lunatic fringe end of that. I spent some time in the field there with some biologists who are going out on these sort of search and destroy missions for reptiles from all over the world.
Big snakes in particular, pythons.
Yeah, snakes and giant lizards, 7-foot-long African monitor lizards. Tegu lizards have just turned up from South America, and they're loose in the in the area just outside the park boundary. The scientists and biologists there are trying to keep them out of the park by going out and trapping them. There's about 1,200 alien plants loose in South Florida and about 500 alien animals. Places is kind of overrun with species from other places. I call it the Area 51 of alien life in America.
So in this case, what does wilderness mean? Trying to take it back sort of museum style to what it was in 1964?
What wilderness means in the Everglades is that this is the largest chunk left of a tropical ecosystem that's somewhat intact in the United States. It's a very, very precious thing. And these hardworking rangers and scientists are out there just trying to limit the damage and keep what the Everglades was saved for. Much of the Everglades is designated wilderness. It's called the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Wilderness. And they're trying to meet the Wilderness Act's definition, which is that it should be maintained in a natural condition. And that word natural I've written about in this article. It's a problem, isn't it, Tom?
Well, what does it mean to you? I mean, you also looked up in Alaska where they're just trying to keep the boundary intact around wilderness.
Well, you know, the boundary is, in a way, is porous. And I think that at the time, you know, the Wilderness Act came out of a great nervousness on the part of conservationists about automobiles. That was really what drove the Wilderness Act to begin with.
That roads would be laid down everywhere and cars would be streaming in.
Yeah. Roads would unspool. And of course, the first wilderness areas were named administratively by people in the Forest Service. They didn't have Congress's protection. Somebody at the regional office would draw a line around a place and say, okay, this is a wilderness now. And this really happened beginning in 1924. The great forester and conservationist Aldo Leopold and another Forest Service landscape architect, Arthur Carhart, kind of came up with this idea in concert. Arthur Carhart was sent out in 1919 to survey a road into a beautiful lake in Colorado. And when he got there, some mountain guides or some hunting guides who were there every summer sort of invited him over for coffee in their tent at night. And when he got there, they just laid into him and said, "What are you Forest Service people doing? You're going to ruin this place." And he was supposed to lay out cabin lots and so on. And they shamed him. They really gave him a talking to. And he went back to his regional office. And he told his superior there, "I really don't have the heart to do this, and I wonder if we should name this place Roadless." This idea was carried by his supervisor to a meeting with the other forester, Aldo Leopold, who was working down in Arizona and New Mexico. And Leopold kind of scaled it up and recommended to his superior that they take 750,000 acres of the Gila National Forest and name it Roadless. And that was America's first big wilderness area called the Gila Wilderness, 1924. So this really came out of a physical sense of stopping roads. But now it's a complicated world where these things, atmospheric transport carries things like mercury so far from where it's produced. We have mercury settling in our Arctic parks that's from Chinese coal-fired electric plants.
I'm trying to understand the volume of land, American land, that's protected by this. I mean, President Johnson, we heard him talking about 9 million acres. Elsewhere, I'm reading 1.9 million acres. And then I'm reading today that this act created a preservation system that includes nearly 110 million acres in 44 states in Puerto Rico, 5% of the land in the U.S. But does that include national forests and parks that are not, strictly speaking, wilderness?
Yes, that's right. The Wilderness Act was a sort of template of land management restrictions that could be placed by Congress over any existing land management scheme. So the original wilderness areas that Leopold and Carhart made were thought up in the Forest Service. Later, many areas of roadless national parks were given wilderness status, and this protects them in the future against, say, a plan that somebody might have to build a hotel or a road or an aerial tramway or something. So there are wilderness areas, as I've just mentioned, say, inside Everglades. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Wilderness is inside, comprises much of Everglades. There's a huge wilderness inside Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, for example. Much of the Yosemite backcountry is wilderness, and so on.
I'm thinking of two different views of this. I was reading Timothy Egan in the New York Times recently, writing about in the American West, which has a very heavily urbanized population now. But he was celebrating the fact that those urban Westerners can so easily and almost uniquely among countries move from that American urban setting in the American West to wilderness or something very close to it within not many miles of the city. And he was celebrating this great kind of combination side by side of healthy cities and healthy wild areas. On the other hand, when President Johnson, we heard his voice there when he's signing this, imagining that climax ecology, that stable ecosystem that would go on forever, you can draw boundaries around this land and still have it deeply degraded by climate change, by mercury out of China and all the rest. How do you size up the health of our wilderness lands in 2014?
Well, you know, there's lots of depressing news about nature today, but I think there's reason to celebrate the success of this program. You mentioned the original 9 million acres that were sort of grandfathered in at the time of the signing of the bill by President Johnson. And you mentioned that now almost 101 million acres have been added to that system for a total of about 110 million. And this is an incredible bouquet of American landscapes in better shape than you can find outside them. There was a really great study released last week, the 27th of August, by researchers in three different countries, the UK, South Africa, and Australia, who digested 30 years of data in other studies about what protected areas like wilderness areas were doing. And what they found was what you might think from just common sense conclusion is that these areas are doing their job. They are protecting great storehouse, the great treasure of life on Earth. They have more species in them, and there are more individuals of all these animals and plants than you find in surrounding landscapes. You know, I mentioned Aldo Leopold, the great forester of the early 20th century and mid-20th century. He said the first law of tinkering with a machine is you don't throw away the parts. And I think that wilderness, even in the face of these challenges that that we're talking about, these places have a tremendous role in keeping the pieces as we learn and figure out nature, because we really don't know enough to engineer the planet the way that I think some people might have understood your previous guest to be saying.
And yet it's clear that nothing can protect. I mean, boundaries don't protect from those atmospheric inputs, even climate inputs that you described. Did President Johnson have any idea in 1964 about the kind of threats that could come from planetary change and atmospheric movement?
No, of course. This was a time when, you know, it would be hard for them to imagine a world where sea levels are rising due to anthropogenic or human causes, and where our ocean water is a third more acid from dissolved carbon dioxide than theirs was. But, you know, these great pieces of legislation like the Wilderness Act and like the Constitution and like the Bill of Rights, it's part of the nature of them that we have to keep plumbing the intention of the framers and make them relevant and keep making them relevant to our present world. And, you know, I really feel that way about the Wilderness Act. You know, if you look at the Bill of Rights, say the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable search and seizure of your private areas of your life, the framers of that Bill of Rights could not have imagined a world where the cloud contains as much data and information about the individual, everything you purchase with your credit card, everywhere you go, the GPS in your phone. Who could have imagined this level of invasion of privacy? And yet, these principles in the Bill of Rights are sort of, for our purposes, eternal.
Jordan, what's your favorite bit of wilderness? Put us there for just a second. We've got you for half a minute more. Take us there.
Well, I mean, if I lived in the 1830s or 40s, I would have gone to see the bison migrate across the Great Plains. And so I wanted to see, you know, a comparable spectacle that still exists on the American landscape, the migration of caribou from Arctic Canada into the Arctic United States to calve and feed their young on the Arctic Plain. And I went and did that. And I walked around up there in that tundra with my son. It took a long, long bush plane flight to get in there. And then we waited and walked around for days and days looking for the caribou. And when we saw them, they flowed like water over the land. There was this great sea of brown coming over this Arctic tundra. And, I'll never forget it.
Jordan Fisher Smith, his piece in Orion Magazine is The Wilderness Paradox. You can read it at our website, a link to it, onpointradio.org. Jordan, in Sacramento, California today, thank you so much for being with us on this 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. Thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Happy wilderness to you.
Happy wilderness. As happy as we can make it. We'll go out with the sound of the chestnut-backed chickadee, recorded by Bob McGuire in 2012 in the Philip Burton Wilderness on the Northern California coast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.